transformation, now in light of what analysts see as a massive U.S. attempt to choke Lebanon politically and economically, the resistance progress is unhindered. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A little crumbling space filled with dirt and garbage. Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of New Delhi is no more than an open prison for the members of the community who face constant threats and intimidation from law enforcement agencies. They say all their activities are being monitored and reported to the local police station on a daily basis. A member of the community is given that task, but that is not the only trouble.
My son was picked up by police along with his wife from outside our shanty 4 months ago. He did not commit any crime. He has been in a detention center for a long time now. I'm worried for him. The UN Refugee Agency says they are working on the case, but nothing has been done so far. He was working as a day laborer in nearby colonies. He did nothing wrong. I humbly urge for his release. We thank God that India gave us shelter, but there is constant fear of detention in the camp.
In recent weeks, the Delhi High Court ordered a joint inspection of the Rohingya Detention Center in New Delhi by officials of concerned agencies over the alleged lack of basic amenities. The court was hearing a plea of a female refugee who is facing bad health conditions due to the lack of basic facilities in the detention center.
My brother recently got married and he was detained just 3 days after his wedding along with his wife. Since then, he's in a detention center. My mother is blind and she cries every day for him. We have been living here for years and we are grateful to India for giving us refugees. I sell vegetables on the streets and similarly other men do menial work, but we are scared now since detention fear is looming across camps.
Most refugees here have heartbreaking tales of the past, and those memories of carnage and exodus are haunting them. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports put the figures at hundreds of thousands. Most of the refugees I spoke with feared that their identity would be disclosed, given the high risk of detention. Scores have also gone into hiding at undisclosed locations across India. They have a horrific tales of separation from their families amid a persistent deportation campaign and an intensified crackdown against the community. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Heads of NGOs in Syria have gathered to loudly voice an urgent need for help. In Damascus, more than 550 NGOs read out a statement before media outlets calling on the U.S. to lift its unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, explaining the years-long siege deprived Syria from its basic needs and equipment needed to rescue those affected by the deadly earthquake.
Today, I apologize to the victims who we heard their voices under the rubble but could not help. Our volunteers were hearing them but couldn't save them because we do not have necessary equipment. 12 years of sanctions left us without required vehicles and rescue equipment. Many people died under the rubble because of those sanctions.
Speakers say the recent ease of U.S. sanctions on Syria to help humanitarian aid reach the country is not effective. That's because banks, companies, and governments around the world are still reluctant to engage with Syria, as they might face legal obstacles in the future. Western states claim that food and medicine is not included in their list of sanctions, but the reality is vastly different.
Sanctions have affected my life, my neighbors, and all Syrian people. We don't have fuel or electricity, and this has raised prices of everything like food and medicine. This is unbearable, especially after the earthquake.
We all here came to say lift economic sanctions. This country cannot stand any more suffering. Even before the earthquake, we were collapsing economically. Those sanctions are only affecting the ordinary people, not the government.
Here, rescue workers are in a battle against time. The death toll keeps rising, and those who could get away from the earthquake are now struggling to survive with a lack of food and shelter. Syrians say it's about time the U.S. and its Western allies end the economic siege that has caused enormous pain and suffering for innocent citizens. They ask for a just and fair world where humanity comes first before all political agendas. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
We're used to the revolving door of Westminster politics, with prime ministers coming and going at dizzying speed. North of the border, things have been much more stable for many years, until this week.
In my head and in my heart, I know that time is now. That it is right for me, for my party, and for the country. And so today I am announcing my intention to step down as First Minister and leader of my party.
Speculation is rife about why she quit, such as the impact of the pandemic and the UK's top court ruling last year against Scottish Government's ability to hold a second independent referendum without approval from the British Parliament. But there's one reason that stands out the most.
Her undoing was brought about by the very controversial GRR bill, which would have given people the ability to change their gender after 3 months without a medical certificate. This outraged many feminist groups in Scotland, and it was passed with a big majority in the Scottish Parliament, but was immediately blocked by the Westminster Parliament.
Sturgeon's resignation has also raised the important question of what will happen to Scotland's independence aspirations in her absence from frontline politics. After all, she was the architect of the referendum in 2014 and has pushed for a second one since the first didn't get a majority vote.
The majority of Scots do want independence. This stepping down of the First Minister will be seen as a setback, but it's not a major setback.
With that in mind, a lot will depend on who emerges as the leader of Sturgeon's Scottish Nationalist Party. Some of the names who might throw their hats in the ring: John Swinney, Deputy First Minister; Hamza Youssef, Scottish Cabinet Secretary for Healthcare and Social Care; Kate Forbes, Cabinet Secretary for Finance and Economy; and Angus Robertson, Cabinet Secretary for the Constitution, External Affairs and Culture.
Successive Conservative governments here in London have said that the 2014 referendum was a once-in-a-generation decision and that it cannot be repeated anytime soon. In response, Nicola Sturgeon said she would turn the next Scottish elections into a de facto referendum to ramp up pressure on London to grant another vote. But without her in the driver's seat, it'll now be up to her successor to deliver what she promised. Saipur is up, London.
This is all they have to survive with for now. A little crumbling space filled with dirt and garbage. This Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of New Delhi is no more than an open prison for the members of the community, who face constant threats and intimidation from law enforcement agencies. They say all their activities are being monitored and reported to the local police station on a daily basis. A member of the community is given that task, but that is not the only trouble. This woman says her son has been held in a detention center for months despite having a UN refugee card. With eyes full of tears and a numb voice, she revealed her ordeal.
My son was picked up by police along with his wife from outside our shanty 4 months ago. He did not commit any crime. He has been in a detention center for a long time now. I'm worried for him. The UN Refugee Agency says they are working on the case, but nothing has been done so far. He was working as a day laborer in nearby colonies. He did nothing wrong. I humbly urge for his release. We thank God that India gave us shelter, but there is constant fear of detention in the camp.
In recent weeks, the Delhi High Court ordered a joint inspection of the Rohingya Detention Center in New Delhi by officials of concerned agencies over the alleged lack of basic amenities. The court was hearing a plea of a female refugee who is facing bad health conditions due to the lack of basic facilities in the detention center.
My brother recently got married and he was detained just 3 days after his wedding along with his wife. Since then, he's in a detention center. My mother is blind and she cries every day for him. We have been living here for years and we are grateful to India for giving us refugees. I sell vegetables on the streets and similarly other men do menial work, but we are scared now since detention fear is looming across camps.
Most refugees here have heartbreaking tales of the past, and those memories of carnage and exodus are haunting them. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports put the figures at hundreds of thousands.
Most of the refugees I spoke with feared that their identity would be disclosed, given the high risk of detention. Scores have also gone into hiding at undisclosed locations across India. They have a horrific tales of separation from their families amid a persistent deportation campaign and an intensified crackdown against the community. Munawar Zaman, the outskirts of New Delhi.
Tehran has hosted the first disaster management conference titled Strong Iran. The three-day event has brought together different representatives and experts from various organizations which are responsible for managing natural disasters at the time of crisis. The event is aimed at training responsible organizations to have proper response to natural disasters. Meanwhile, Iran's interior minister addressing the event referred to the earthquakes in Iran, Turkey and Syria and said that the country should maintain its readiness more than ever before.
These events are a warning that we must maintain our preparation more than ever in the past, and dealing with natural disasters requires a modern and not a traditional approach, and the dimensions of these events must be controlled with the help of managerial, human, software and equipment skills.
Iran has been a very disaster-prone country throughout its history. Earthquakes, floods, droughts, inversion effects of air pollution in metropolitans have occurred many times, affected millions of people, and have claimed hundreds of thousands of lives during the past century. According to the World Risk Report, Iran is among the countries with high vulnerability in the world. More than 80,000 people have died during the past 30 years in Iran, directly by natural disasters.
The main objective of crisis management is to identify and prioritize crisis threats to formulate the best strategy for confronting the most immediate ones. Accordingly, holding such an event provides a good opportunity for officials and people to be prepared at the time of crisis. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Lives have been saved in Turkey following recent earthquakes because the country had access to heavy lifting machinery. Experts say many lives were lost in Syria because sanctions prevented the country from having similar equipment. The catastrophe has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Following the disaster, I contacted one of the largest aid agencies in Syria. I've spoken to Italian agencies and other NGOs. They all told me that the EU sanctions present an obstacle to humanitarian work.
European Commission officials told legislators that just 9 of the EU's 27 member states have supplied Syria with support. 21 have scrambled to help Turkey.
The Commission also allocated an additional 3.5 million euros in emergency humanitarian funding to help our partners address urgent needs in Syria.
This 3.5 million euro for Syrians pales into insignificance when compared to the 67 billion euro spent by the EU on Ukraine during the past 11 months. Experts have been saying for years that the bloc lacks unity when it comes to Syria.
Countries are acting in their own way. There is no coordinated action. And this is one of the reasons that we're faced with this very big crisis, this mega crisis.
Efforts by Western nations to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad have failed. Critics say interventionism has brought misery to millions of innocent people in the country. Some lawmakers want the pressure to be paused.
In Syria, there are sanctions. We don't want to see more people die in the cold. They don't have medicines. We must put politics aside and human life first.
It's been announced the EU will host a donors summit next month to gather money for the earthquake-hit regions. Political commentators are claiming it's already obvious that the vast majority of the money raised will go to Turkey, not Syria. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of bed and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society, with poor and middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Hundreds of people attended a national conference in Gaza, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The event aims to bolster the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, extremist Israeli settlers and political figures, backed by regime forces, have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli forces have also killed and injured dozens of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of 2023. Speaking to Press TV, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said the resistance in Gaza is ready to support the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We will not leave the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank alone, and we will back them with all the necessary means. The occupying regime will not be able to divide the Palestinian resistance arenas. Last night, we witnessed unity in Gaza, Nablus, and Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces more than 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom.
Actually, Al-Quds is not just a word. It's something apart from our heart. So this conference asking and telling the world that this Israeli action against Al-Quds and West Bank must be stopped.
Palestinian resistance factions have expressed their unwavering support for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. They also vowed to use all forms of resistance to liberate Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We believe that the Israeli government, under the leading of Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, going to raising up the aggressive against our people in West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Gaza also, maybe in other outside countries also. So we are going to resent the occupation by all kind of resistance.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank while turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Palestinians say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
another option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
According to reports of international human rights organizations and civil institutions in Afghanistan, since the occupation of the country by the U.S. military and its allies in October of 2001 until the time of their chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021, thousands of innocent Afghan civilians have been killed and tens of thousands more have been injured. But the American authorities have never been held accountable for their heinous crimes in the country. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia Today has covered the story and tells us more. An internal military review reportedly concluded that U.S. analysts' incorrect presumptions and prejudices contributed to the chaotic August 2021 Pentagon departure from Afghanistan and resulted in Kabul drone attack that killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. Tensions were running high on the day of the drone strike, just 3 days after the August 26th terrorist bombing that killed 13 U.S. troops and more than 100 Afghans at Kabul airport. The probe by U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, noted that another attack by Daesh terrorists was expected that day, and that intelligence reports indicated it would involve a white Toyota Corolla. The report said military analysts observed a white Toyota Corolla stopping at what they believe was a Daesh compound, so they began tracking the car. After the vehicle pulled into a gated courtyard near the airport just hours later, a Hellfire missile strike on the car by an MQ-9 Reaper drone was ordered. Later on that day, US officials announced that they had successfully prevented another terrorist attack. As reports of civilian deaths began to surface, US officials said they had no indications of such casualties and were investigating whether a secondary explosion might have killed someone. However, CENTCOM's investigation revealed that analysts reported within 20 minutes of the strike that civilians may have been killed. Within 3 hours, they had assessed that at least three Afghan children, were killed. Military officials continued to conceal what they knew about the strike. 3 days later, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, said the attack was righteous and that it had killed a Daesh facilitator and unknown others. The driver of the Toyota Corolla turned out to be an aid worker who had spent the day picking up his employer's laptop, taking colleagues to and from work, and loading canisters of water into his trunk to bring home to his family. The CENTCOM investigation was completed a week and a half after the drone strike and was never released to the public. 16 months later, the US media obtained 66 partially redacted pages of the report, only after suing CENTCOM under the Freedom of Information Act. The probe detailed how biases led analysts to make tragically wrong assumptions. For instance, they concluded that a package loaded into the car containing explosives because of its careful handling and size, and that the driver's erratic route meant he was trying to evade surveillance. The New York Times has also covered the same story. According to a congressionally mandated Pentagon report, the U.S. military, which invaded and illegally occupied Afghanistan for almost two decades, killed 12 Afghan civilians in 2021. The report states they were killed in a botched drone strike the American military carried out in the Afghan capital Kabul on 29th of August 2021. Just one day before the phased U.S. military drawdown ended. According to a report released recently, which constitutes only a fraction of the atrocities unleashed by U.S. occupation forces in Afghanistan, 7 of the 10 Afghan civilians killed in that incident were children. It also documents the killing of an Afghan civilian in a U.S. strike on 8th of January in the western Herat province, and another on 11th of August, in the southern Kandahar province. The botched drone strike in August of 2021 prompted a half-hearted apology from then head of the U.S. Central Command, General Frank McKenzie, who admitted it was a mistake. However, no U.S. military officials or troops were punished or held accountable for that deadly drone strike. The Taliban staged a stunning comeback in August of 2021, toppling the Western-backed government in Kabul and forcing the United States and its allies to abandon the country after years of futile military adventure. For two decades, the war in Afghanistan remained an enigma for the successive U.S. governments, from George W. Bush to Joe Biden, finally ending in a botched military exit and a disgraceful defeat. It started on 29th of February 2020, when then-US President Donald Trump's administration signed an agreement with the Taliban to pull out US troops from the country by 1st of May 2021. However, the deal failed to de-escalate tensions between the two sides. On 14th of April 2021, President Joe Biden announced that the remaining 2,500 to 3,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan would be withdrawn by 11th of September to end what he called America's Forever War. Between May and August of 2021, the Taliban overran several key provincial capitals across Afghanistan, which, with the beleaguered Afghan forces offering little resistance. Amid the ensuing chaos and commotion, on 29th of August 2021, a U.S. drone strike killed 10 family members of an Afghan family, including 7 children, near the airport. In September of 2021, the Pentagon acknowledged it was a tragic mistake, but said none of the military personnel involved in the botched drone strike will face any kind of punishment. The website of NPR has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Pentagon said it would not punish the military team behind the errant drone strike that was intended to hit the masterminds of an attack on Kabul airport, but instead killed 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children. U.S. Defense Department spokesperson John Kirby recently confirmed reports that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin approved a series of recommendations following an investigation into the deadly incident in August of 2021. Those did not include disciplinary action for the military service members involved in what officials had called a tragic mistake. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby told reporters during a briefing, "The Secretary of Defense is now approving or calling for additional accountability measures. I do not anticipate there being issues of personal accountability to be had with respect to the 29th of August airstrike." Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said investigations led by General Kenneth McKenzie, who leads U.S. Central Command, and General Richard Clark, the head of the Special Operations Command, resulted in a series of recommendations for procedural changes and process improvements that need to occur and will occur, adding, "But in this particular case, there was not a strong enough case to be made for personal accountability, and no one was found criminally negligent." An investigation by the Air Force's Inspector General, Lieutenant General Sami Saeed, found the deadly mistake was the result of confirmation bias. The New York Times uncovered video footage that challenged the Pentagon's narrative that officials admitted the drone strike had been a mistake. The strike killed Zamari Ahmadi, an employee of U.S.-based Nutrition and Education International, NEI, and 9 members of his family. Last month, Nutrition and Education International founder and president Steve Kwan called the Pentagon's investigation into the incident deeply disappointing and inadequate. The Pentagon promised to pay compensation and also to help relocate abroad family members and Afghans working for Nutrition and Education International, NEI, but that remains stuck on determining just who is qualified.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the situation of Palestinians would be much different today if Islamic countries had united and fought against the establishment of the Zionist entity from the very beginning. This is according to the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Sayyid Ali Khamenei, during his speech commemorating the day when Prophet Muhammad became a prophet. In his address to Iranian officials as well as Islamic leaders from other countries, he said that enemies resorting to Iranophobia is because of Iran's outward support for the Palestinians. And the leader said Tehran will continue to support Palestine in any way possible and said that all Islamic countries have a responsibility to condemn Israeli atrocities and to be united with each other. Well, we're going to talk more about this situation overall dealing with the Palestinians. And first, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Elijah McNear, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels, and Fra Hughes, journalist, author, and activist out of Belfast. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in Brussels. Tell me your overall perspective. I mean, when Ayatollah Khamenei used this occasion to mark the importance of the Palestinian cause for the Muslim world, your overall perspective on and why that was chosen and significance of it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
The point of the Palestinian cause, it is the forgotten cause, because most Arab nations are normalizing with Israel and the international community, including the Western community, is no longer advertising for the right cause of the Palestinians to return to their land and have their own state. So it is very important to always bring out the Palestinian cause because it represents the injustice that a large number of the population, the people of Palestine, are suffering. And because the West seems to be, claimed to be, very sensitive to human rights, and when we see nothing is happening, Then we see other countries like in Iran, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, and a few other countries who are really concerned about the Palestinian cause and support the Palestinian cause. We see how the injustice is hitting the Palestinian cause in a place where they have absolutely no right. It is the only place in the world where Israel maintains a prison for the bodies, 375 bodies maintained by Israel. In the yearly annual report that I've seen only a week ago, when the Joseph Borrell, the vice president of the EU Commission, acknowledged that there were 150 Palestinians, of which 33 children were killed last year, the report never mentioned anything about it. The UN condemned it. The US condemned the Israeli building of settlement, yet the settlements are built since 1948. There is no accountability whatsoever to the Israelis. This is why someone needs to remind the world about the right cause of the Palestinian, keep it in alive in the memory, particularly when we see the youth in Palestine are not forgetting and are claiming their territory back.
Well, Frank Hughes, you know, Iran has never hidden its support for the Palestinian and has paid a big price because of its support for the Palestinian cause. I mean, your overall analysis as a journalist of why do you think that Tehran has been so insistent and consistent with its support on Palestine since the beginning of the revolution, really, in 1979?
Hello, everyone. I think what we're maybe witnessing in Iran, that was a people's-led revolution, so we can assume that some of the policies that were absorbed into the Islamic Republic of Iran, not necessarily into the constitution, but into the fibre of society, into the body politics of what's happening on the ground. I think Iran is a bulwark against Zionism. If we look at Syria, I believe the main reason why Syria was attacked is because it is also a bulwark against Zionism, aggression and expansionism in West Asia. I think they were going for the domino effect of first we create ISIS, Daesh will destroy Syria, and then we'll either send in that army of mercenaries, murderers and bloodthirsty psychopaths either into the Caucasus or against Iran. So Iran has the moral high ground. The Iranian government, the people of the world, actually, I believe, the majority of the people of the world, support the Palestinian people in their call for self-determination and sovereignty. But it is the Zionist-supporting, Zionist-leaning governments of these countries that refuse to acknowledge the plight and the suffering and the oppression of the Palestinian people under the apartheid Israeli military occupation. So people support Palestine, governments support Tel Aviv and Zionism. But I think the one place where you find, it's not just the one place, but one of the few places that you find the people and the government are walking in tandem on Palestine is Iran, is Yemen. It would have been Libya. It is Syria. It might have been Iraq, although more and more the Iraqi government seems to be standing up for Palestinian rights. And the crocodile tears and the hypocritical hand-wringing of the West about the continuing building of the illegal settlements, the continuing massacre of unarmed civilians in Palestine, in the occupied West Bank, by the Israeli forces, just shows that the West has fallen into a morass of immorality and corrupt politics, and one of the few beacons of political morality, I believe, in the world is in West Asia, and it is Iran, and it is Syria, and it is the likes of Cuba and Venezuela and Nicaragua, governments and Yemen, governments where people stand up, where the governments stand up for their people. And that is the way politics should be. And Iran should have everyone's support as it stands firmly against Zionist aggression.
Okay, well, Elijah, how much do you think that Tehran's support for Palestinian has led to this Iran phobia or anti-Iran sentiments that we see?
This is one of the elements that the West uses to attack Iran, because it is a question of ideology for Iran to support Palestine and the Palestinians. It is also part of the Iranian constitution to support the oppressed people around the world. So anything that Iran is doing is criticized and the country is demonized, because Iran, first, is not submitted to the West. Secondly, it is claiming the right of the Palestinian, which is their legitimate right. And this is for the West. They see it as a danger to Israel expansion and existence. And Israel screams very loud by saying Iran wants to get rid of us, not acknowledging that they are really stealing the rights of the Palestinian, constructing settlement, misbehaving with the Palestinian, committing crime against humanity, against the UN Charter. So because of these elements, the behavior of Iran is called malign, because it doesn't fit with the Western mentality, it doesn't fit with the Western objectives. On the contrary, it contradicts it, because Iran is supporting the Palestinian, and supporting the Palestinian, like the Palestinian told us many times publicly, there are no limits and no conditions for what Iran is doing to the Palestinian, which means for the first time we see a genuine relationship where a country is not imposing its demand or its condition or its politics on another country or other people, the population, particularly in Gaza and the West Bank, without demanding anything in exchange. So the only objective is to free Palestine, and this is something that the West can't afford, because there's nothing is given for free. And that's why the model that Iran is offering is extremely dangerous for the West.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
We saw during the recent World Cup how many Muslims sympathize with the Palestinian cause. However, most of their governments have been bullied or bought off, basically, into accepting Israel or turning a blind eye to the atrocities. Do you think that we're in the process of seeing a growing schism or separation between these Muslim nations and these rulers who have submitted to the Zionists, or your assessment of this whole situation?
I think there has always been that disconnect. I mean, I did mention earlier that I feel the people of the world as such support the Palestinians as an oppressed people who deserve the right to self-determination, yet it is the governments who support the Zionist apartheid state. It's exactly the same in West Asia. A lot of those, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, if we go back to the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the redrawing of the borders in what they call the Middle East, I mean, all the problems created today stem from them. A lot of those countries, the Gulf monarchies, they send their soldiers and their generals to Sandhurst to be trained. They send their children to Oxford to be educated. They are all Anglophiles, and they see, this is the leaders of many of these countries, see more in common with the Western values of the likes of the United Kingdom and more with Israel than they do with the kind of Muslim Ummah that's spread throughout the region and across the world. I think there are 2 billion, would there be 2 billion Muslims in the world? That's an awful lot of people who support the Palestinians. And I think it's important that if we look at the fact that a lot of these places like Saudi Arabia, they're not democracies. You can't vote in the government. You can't vote out bad policies. You have to put up with the dictatorship of the monarchy. I think what we saw in Morocco, and indeed I was in Marrakesh on holiday during the World Cup, and I saw people come out with the Moroccan flags during Morocco's games that they played during the World Cup, and I saw people with the Palestinian flags celebrating too. So, you know, basically until they get rid of the dictators in West Asia, we will continue to have the schism between the people and the governments. And the problem is the people are unarmed and the governments are armed, and a lot of them will not hesitate to bring the troops out onto the street to repress any dissent within the nation. And we've seen people go to jail for 10, 20, 30 years for putting up a tweet about the about Mohammed bin Salman as the Saudi Arabian leader. People going to jail for a tweet. So while there is corruption and while these corrupt leaders move closer and closer to the other corrupt leaders like Netanyahu within the region, I see no real opportunities other than the axis of resistance to stand against Zionism and to stand up for Palestinian rights under international law.
Well, Elijah, we seem to be unfortunately witnessing a record year of Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied territory. Israel has also just approved 9 more settlements, which are all illegal under international law. Do you think the scenario would be the same if Muslim countries were united in standing up against the Israeli regime? And how likely, in your perspective, do you see this happening anytime soon?
It's very unlikely for the Arab countries and the Muslim countries to stop their contact and normalization with Israel, because they have chosen a path that is, as your guest rightly said, there's a huge gap between the population and the leaders. So the leaders are taking unpopular decision, and we've seen the reaction of the population. Therefore, as long as these leaders are not in connection with the people, they will insist on their position because they are more or less intimidated by the U.S. bullying. And the U.S. is the bully of the world, imposing its will on all the countries. Otherwise, they will wage war or impose sanctions to cripple the population and turn the population unhappy against their rulers. This is why it is very unlikely for these countries to stop the relationship with Israel and to impose on the Israelis to respect the right of the Palestinians. Moreover, on the other hand, I think that what is happening today is not negative, is not all bad. They're having a very extreme right-wing government in Israel and having extreme measures by the Israelis is increasing the resistance, is making the voice louder among the Palestinians, making them more united. New groups are coming out. Youngsters between the age of 20 and 25 are responding to the Israeli aggression. They're rejecting it, including in the West Bank, those who were given Israeli identity, those who never known the PLO or the Democratic Palestinian Group or all the other different factions who started fighting the armed war against the Israelis in the 70s and in the 80s and in the 90s. So we are seeing a new generation, thanks to the behavior of the Arabs who tend to separate themselves from the Israeli cause, thanks to the radical behavior of the Israeli responsible, thanks to the extreme measures that the Israelis are pushing the Palestinians to the extreme, then there will be a reaction. And perhaps this reaction, if it increases and the Palestinians are united in Palestine, well, maybe the changes can happen. And that could influence on the Arab, like Qatar, who maintains some relationship with Israel. Nonetheless, it has a position where it is asking for the right of the Palestinians, which is better than nothing, although maintaining contact with the Israelis. On the other hand, we see the Saudis having good contact with the Israelis, but not declaring their normalization, and they have also meeting, etc., and without mentioning the Emirates, Bahrain, and other countries. So all this behavior of the Arab leaders is, in the eyes of the population, is shameful. In the eyes of the Palestinians, well, they know what they, we know what they think, but they voice it because they don't want to stop any possible support to the Palestinian population that is under the Israeli threat.
Right. Well, back to Belfast. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders have said that Iran is Israel's main enemy. The significance of that, and why do you think that they continue to say that?
I'd say their main enemy for the Israelis is the people they're murdering on the West Bank and the people they have under an inhuman, unacceptable, illegal siege in Gaza. They will claim that Iran is their number one enemy because if you are Israeli, if you are the prime minister of that country, if you are a right-wing, right-leaning, fascist-thinking thug in the government in Israel, you're going to look around and say, who are our friends and who doesn't like us? And I believe Syria was attacked because it stands for Palestine. I believe Iran will constantly be under threat. We have heard recently of the American administration taking the MEK off the terrorist watch list, which implies that the CIA are potentially going to start arming them, which is where I would see that leading to. So Israel, as an apartheid Zionist state, sees Iran as the leader of the axis of resistance against Zionist apartheid expansionism in West Asia. It sees Iran as helping the people of Lebanon when they try to give them fuel, of helping the people of Gaza to break the siege, of standing side by side, shoulder to shoulder with the people of Syria in denying Daesh and Western hegemony the opportunity of destroying the Syrian Arab Republic. So you have a secular Arab Republic closely allied to a theocratic Shia Persian government. So what we have are two, they're not diametrically opposed, they're two separate systems that have come together in common humanity to help each other in the face of the regional aggressor, which is the Western-inspired colony of Israel.
Well, what about that, Elijah? You just heard what Frost said, and I just want to pick up on that because he talked about the type of government that Iran has as opposed to Syria. And other, I mean, the main thing that the Western countries a lot of times and the Israelis talk about is